Up first this hour, though, we welcome into the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming, who joins us from the greater Boston area. Mr. Fleming, good afternoon.
How's it going, Rich Guy?
We're doing all right here today. You're a walker. You're out there putting the miles on every day. I don't complain about the weather much, and I like the winter okay, but well, are you getting that ice that makes it difficult to get around without risking falling on your noggin?
Yeah, I've been faltering a bit lately, too. I haven't done a great job with the whole exercising. I didn't do anything today. I only did 1,000 stairs yesterday, but when I went out, it was like a gale. It was pretty brutal, but there's that ice where, especially on bricks, I've noticed this. A heads up or a heads down, downtown ends, right? You're going to want to pay attention to bricks because you can never see the ice on the bricks.
Right.
The bricks are just slicker than any other hard substance you might be walking on in winter. I mean, I pick up these weird little things over the years of all the walking. I think I mentioned to you once that if you see a discarded nip of whiskey, there is no way, like it's a minor miracle, it's not going to be a fireball. I know a guy like you likes to kick back some fireballs, like the devil's brew and all that stuff. That's your thing. but like, it's people, if you're walking around, maybe you know this, Kimball, you're walking with fireball and you're just chucking that empty nip when it's done. But yes, nips on the ground of fireball and brick ice is what I go down on average at least once a year. And I go down pretty hard. I just hope there is not some hot young filly beholding this because I don't want her judging me for my lack of ice-based skills, which is ironic given my hockey background.
Yeah, well, she would throw that empty bottle of fireball right at you.
I'd be like Mississippi John Hurt. I'd pop right back up, and I'd just say, I woke up boozy, and run off. No, I'm up to 289 straight weeks of alcohol-free living, so no booziness.
Well done. Well done indeed, sir. Well, we're talking avant-garde art today. How would you define such a thing, Colin?
Oh, Kimball, you're one of those people who's putting it all on me. Okay. I'll pull the wagon. Avant-garde art, I think for a lot of people out there, means, oh no, I don't understand this at all. It makes no sense. This sucks. I'm out of here. But that is not how I would look at efficacious avant-garde art. I think avant-garde art can be clear and it can be inclusive. What it's going to do is take risks with form in a way that we have events depicted not the way that they would occur out in the world, so we're not hewing to the rules of natural order, but at the same time, paradoxically or not, we're getting to human truths. So avant-garde art can be mainstream art at the same time, and I think that's something that people don't take into consideration. I could give you an example from like the popular music world. I would say there are aspects of Pet Sounds or Sergeant Pepper that are avant-garde art. It's not just Revolution Number 9 from the White Album, which is just sort of outright avant-garde art where it's not an attempt to be inclusive. But I think those other examples show that we can all be brought in into this world and we shouldn't be scared of the term. I think that's really what I want to dispel, this notion of avant-garde art is something that we should be trepidatious about.
All right, well, let's start with a radio adaptation of a work by Franz Kafka, A Country Doctor. Let's listen to a little bit. I believe this is from 1964 of The Black Mass.
What a perplexity. What a perplexity. I should be starting on an urgent journey. Seriously ill patient is waiting for me in a village 10 miles away. But between him and me, a thick blizzard fills all the wide spaces. I have a gig, a light gig with big wheels, exactly right for our country roads. Muffled in furs. My bag of instruments in my hand.
Well, a very atmospheric piece there. First of all, Colin, I have read Country Doctor before, but tell me about The Black Mass. I was totally unfamiliar with that.
Sure. So this is two-pronged, and maybe somebody like you needs to spend a little more time on my website, Mr. Kimball. Although, to be fair, maybe I've not gotten this up yet, because who knows, there's like 1,000 links that are missing. But to no surprise of yours at all, I once wrote a giant feature on the Black Mass. So it's a radio program, and these radio programs, these that you'd gather around the radio and listen to, were at their end in the late 1950s. So that's when we have like Gunsmoke, we've talked about that, and yours truly, Johnny Dollar. But come 1960, that's all pretty much over. Television's going to replace that, but the plucky Black Mass, having made a deal with the devil, is going to carry on for a lot of the 1960s, and it was helmed by a guy named Eric Bauersfeld. And if you know that name today, you might know him as the voice of, do you know?
No, I don't. Yeah. No.
He's the voice of Admiral Akbar. So, it's a trap, Kimball!
Oh,
yeah. That's him. And it wasn't a one-man production exactly, but it felt one-man-ish, where it was him doing these works of literature. We have a couple from M.R. James, we have Saki, we have Henry James, we have Gogol, and it was horror, and it was smart, and it was literate, and it was based on the West Coast. And actually, Kimball, I was thinking, I could hear you doing a version of a show like this in this era. I just think it's something that your voice would work well with. So anyway, for this, we have a completely gonzo episode based upon Kafka's The Country Doctor, A Country Doctor. And really, you can't put that quote-unquote blame on the Black Mass, because the story itself by Kafka is pretty out there. It's about a doctor who is called away 10 miles from his home, and he doesn't want to go, and it's snowing out, as you could hear there in the audio sample, and he's pissed, and like he goes over to like his barn, and this groom comes out. He doesn't expect a groom to come out, and the groom just wants to manhandle like the doctor's maid, but he has like this way to get the doctor there fast, and the doctor's like, cool. He goes off by himself, leaves like his maid to, well, I mean, it's not really great what's going to happen to her. And he goes up to the patient in the bed, and they're all happy to see him because the doctor's finally showed up, and the patient's like, let me die. And the doctor's like, no, come on, brother. It's cool. There's not even anything wrong with you. And he's like, oh, wait, I'll take another look. Oh, there's a big hole in you with all these worms in it. This sucks. Let me get in bed with you. And they lay there until the doctor's like, I'm kind of pissed. Don't respect me. No one takes my services seriously. I will jump out the window and ride away. And though it took him like a minute to get there and 10 miles in the first place, when he leaves, he's like, ah, wow, this takes forever. I hate being a doctor. Oh, well. I mean, it's pretty nuts. In Kafka, one time Kafka's publisher was like, sometimes I think I'm a bit like this because of the situation I'm in more than anything for the present time. But Kafka's publisher was like, you don't take like a hand with your own books. It's like you just write them and you don't care and you don't do the publicity. And Kafka was just like, fine, you all suck. I'm just doing the stuff about like people turning into bugs and crazy doctors. Leave me alone.
Well, it's a fascinating broadcast. And again, I knew the story, but they do a wonderful job of, I don't want to say making sense of it, but really, I think reveling in that surrealism of the story.
Sure. Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. The thing is, you have to, we've talked about this before with certain books I've done like Dark March and Anglerfish Comedy Troupe. And the reason that the stories work is because they're not set up like, okay, this is going to be weird. We're violating some rules of natural order. When you do something along those lines, you have to simply go with it as if that's the way things actually are. Because when you do that, people will buy into the reality contained within that work. And the reality contained within that work is going to lead them at the same time to realities out in, if not the natural world, the psychological world and the emotional world. And I think that's what avant-garde art can be great at, is getting to those truths of emotionalism and psychology rather than maybe like the time the sun sets.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Up next, a wonderful photograph from 1924 from Man Ray. Let's see if I can work my high school French here. Le Violin d'Ingres, something like that.
I think we can just call it Ingres's Violin.
Okay, so, oh, fine.
We'll go with that. We don't need like Godard phoning in and being like, I always listen to you guys. That was wrong. So it's a very cheeky photo. And again, it's accessible. And if people out there don't know the photo, what it is, it's Man Ray's smoking hot girlfriend, and she's in the nude. Ah, she has her back to us. We only see like the top of her rear end, so that's a little disappointing on the titillation front. And she has the sound hole, like the F holes on the violin in her back. And so it's a visual joke. It's a riff, too, on the mutability of form, which would appeal to someone who made avant-garde art, the mutability of thingness, really. That the body is also something that can be played or played upon, and which, of course, too, can be reversed. And the lover plays the photographer. So there's a yin and a yang to this particular photograph. And it's striking. It's not like as out there as, okay, here's the urinal that's meant to be a stand-in, a statement for a work of art. Because it works, too, as just self-contained photography.
Right. Up next, a wonderful short film from 1938, Joseph Cornell's The Midnight Party. This, I've seen this before. Wow, it's just a blast.
It is. So I can tell from your statement there that you are not Salvador Dali. Salvador Dali confronted Joseph Cornell one time when this was shown. And Cornell was a very reticent man, and accepting a few years of high school at Phillips Academy, fancy. He lived with his mother and his brother, who suffered from cerebral palsy, in Queens, and off of Utopia Parkway, which sounds like the name of one of Cornell's shadow boxes. And he, to mix up the evening's entertainment, using an M.R. James term, he would edit these films, these 16mm films, and change the endings, and he didn't know it was coming. So it was found footage stuff. Later, he would actually shoot himself, but that's not what he was doing here. And so he didn't have any kind of social life. He never, like, went further than the New York area after he left high school. He didn't graduate from high school. And so he's creating these filmic collage works of art. And The Midnight Party, so it's all, like, found footage. Anyone could have gone out and done this from available materials. It's only 4 minutes long, and I would really suggest that people go out and watch this. Joseph Cornell is one of my favorite artists, and I think if anyone knows anything about him, they're going to know about his boxes. So he would just assemble bric-a-brac stuff, like around your house, like your kid's Barbie doll, and like a shoebox type of thing, and put glass, and he would just put some stars, but it was like these visual shadow box stories. And so when his films are screened, it's usually only in connection with the boxes being exhibited. And that's not how he looked at these two outgrowths of his artistry. He viewed them as separate things. So in this, we have everything from an amoeba at the beginning. It's really a smorgasbord of what we might consider a midnight party of the imagination. Yeah. We have this female dancer that looks like she's almost being pulled up as if she were a fish caught on the line. We have a weather vane, tightrope, an observatory at night, a naked young girl on a horse, Thor sort of getting cross that his lightning isn't working the way he wants it to in conjunction with his hammer. And it's just the rhythm of the film. He had a natural rhythm for filmmaking. Orson Welles did too. But it's interesting to see that with Joseph Cornell, because we don't think of him as like a cinematic auteur necessarily.
Well, it's worth your time to go find it again. It's only 4 minutes long, but you can find it on YouTube, The Midnight Party, Joseph Cornell. Next up, some poetry, and really enjoyed reading The Embankment and then learning a bit more about poet T.E. Hume.
He was a lot of different things, and he didn't write a ton of poetry. He might have written more, but as you just learned, Kimball, he, well, how's the line go from, like, one of his contemporaries? He was literally blown to pieces in the Great War. And he was blown to pieces, I would say, in a highly poetic way, because a shell was coming in, and while his comrades fell to the ground and covered themselves, Hume was lost in deep thought, and then he blew up. So, thinking about that today, I'm thinking, like, that would probably be how I go if one of, like, the crazy stalkers I have doesn't assassinate me. Anyway, so The Embankment is very short. I'll just read the entire thing. It's called The Fantasia of a Fallen Gentleman, subtitled rather, on a cold, bitter night. Once, in finesse of fiddles, found I ecstasy, and the flash of gold heels on the hard pavement. Now see I that warmth's the very stuff of poesy. O God, make small the old star-eaten blanket of the sky, that I may fold it round me and in comfort lie. This is interesting because we have modernism at work here. We have the poetry of imagism, which was not romanticism because it was more straightforward. It's more cubist in nature, but verbally. And so you have these images that so much depends upon, right? We all know kind of that one, like left over from English lit class. But I find at the end of this, there is, don't you hear it too? There is an element of our man John Clare, that I may fold it round me in comfort lie. That has a little bit of the timbre of Clare's I Am, which is my favorite poem, and which we've discussed. So Hume was a critic, so he would have known the Clare poem, but you have this sort of blend, this estuarial coming together of the old forms of romanticism, imagism coming in, and cubism coming in, and modernism coming in, and it's just like, what, 17, 20, 25 words, and there you go.
And I was reading how he, in his critical writing, wrote about the difference between romanticism and classicism.
Yes, and so the way I think he captures it well, because when he talks about classicism, he's talking about technique and a very human, controlled, to put it in a sports term, classicism would be like scripting the first 25 plays, 15 plays, whatever it is, right, of the game, the NFL game, the playoff game. Whereas romanticism is more transcendent, saying, okay, these are human things, but let's see how we go beyond human things, or let's put us in situations where we have to adapt. Maybe it would be like changing up the game plan when something else isn't working and using something that you never expected to use and you had never even thought of before. And now that you've realized it, it's something that you would have considered beyond yourself. So be a football and T.E. Hume, we can get to the difference between romanticism and classicism. So that's the kind of thing with this, the way people talk about avant-garde art, the way people talk about art, any kind of art, especially nowadays, it's meant to, like, people think it's scary. And so then they just flock to the Marvel movie or whatever, and they suck down society even more each day. This stuff isn't scary. The way I'm talking about this, anyone can understand what I'm saying. It's all accessible, and you get more bang, too, for your entertainment dollar. This isn't like some fusty old professor telling you this. This is your buddy, the sea dog.
And we mentioned Hume's untimely end. I love the description of what came afterwards when I said, what was left of him was buried in the military cemetery in Belgium. What was left of him?
Yes. And, you know, there's sort of like a creepy, discordant note in that, too, that this is the Great War. And he's sort of talked about as just gets lumped in with the war poets. Rupert Brooke was another one. Rupert Brooke was crucial to Fitzgerald finding the title for This Side of Paradise, because as you well know, Kimball, This Side of Paradise, there's little comfort in the wise. And that was from Rupert Brooke. So you also get this sensation, though, of like the cemeteries were jam-packed. And so when you had someone who was mere strips at that point, that it saved some space to get some more people in there. These were very dark days. And I think, like, I have a buddy who's like, what you're dealing with in publishing, I tell you to go on, I believe it's going to work out. The metaphor he'll always give is like, but I'm not going over the top of the trench each day like you are. So I think you really have to sort of understand how horrific war, I mean, it's not like war was ever zippity-doo-dah, but it was even more horrific, I think, during this time. So for him to go out that way, and he wasn't like as young as Rupert Brooke. He was in his middle 30s when he died. So this was a guy believing in and fighting for the cause when a lot of people at the time in battle were younger.
All right, finally this afternoon, let's listen to a little bit of John Coltrane in a recently discovered recording done in Seattle in 1965. Mm-hmm. Colin, am I right? This is one of only two known live recordings of his great album, A Love Supreme.
As if you could be wrong. Yes, you are correct. So this is early autumn, 1965. And there's more Coltrane from Seattle. You can find out there on Bootleg. And so there's been material around, findable, for quite some time. Even there's another, there's like an FM broadcast on YouTube if people want to check that out. But yes, this is the famous Love Supreme. And it's the quartet right at the end of being the quartet. And the quartet is, however you wish to look at it, one of the greatest small units in the history of jazz. I find that Coltrane's most interesting music, it delineates pretty clearly for me, was made between 1961 and 65. I think his work with Miles Davis prior to 1961, and then some of the directions he'd go into in the remaining couple years of his life. He dies in 1967. They're more unwieldy. They're not uninteresting, and they have moments of incandescent beauty, but they don't have the driving, quest-like focus of the 1961 to 65 material. So this is really the last of it, and they're feeling this out on stage, because it wasn't something that was meant to be played on stage a lot. Coltrane was meticulous in writing this. You can find photos out there of like all the charts and everything. And I feel like it's sort of like one of the last cohesive moments for this unit, because Elvin Jones, I did this giant feature for Jazz Times, like in August, I think, on Extension, which is the album where Elvin Jones was like the drummer. He's like, I've had enough of this. I can't even play this stuff. You can't even hear me. This sucks. McCoy Tyner was really drowned out. And in that excerpt there, apparently you wanted to find like Jimmy Garrison, the bassist, and McCoy Tyner, the pianist, by themselves. McCoy Tyner really shines. I was listening to this the other day while running stairs. And the Elvin Jones drum solo, you're going to want to check that out on this recording. And if you listen to like the first two or three minutes or whatever it is, Coltrane lays out, which meaning he doesn't play. These other guys, the other three, are doing their thing before he even enters. And I think this is something too. People don't say this about Coltrane. I find him diffusive when he switches to soprano saxophone. Here he's just on tenor. And to me, that's where he should have stuck. He wasn't like Eric Dolphy, who's like, okay, alto sax, and I'll do bass clarinet, like we talked about with God Bless the Child. So you want meaty, hard-charging, deep-thinking tenor saxophone John Coltrane.
And apparently in this recording, too, what I listened to, you get to hear a lot of Elvin Jones because the mic was positioned pretty close to him.
I love stuff like that about live recordings, certain ones. Yes, and you're right about that, too. It reminds me of, if you listen to the Star Club tapes of the Beatles, which I'm writing about now for a couple books, the tape recorder was near Lennon. So you hear a lot of the rhythm guitar. And it's fascinating, like, if people are able to pick up on this, because you hear how so much of the Beatles sound was built up from his rhythm guitar. And we don't think of him as a guitarist, but he was in many ways the percussive driving force of the band. And that's when they had like Ringo Starr and everything. So he had joined by then. So yes, you get a lot of good Elvin Jones on this. And his solo, which obviously is just him, I think it's one of the best solos he did. And you have to realize too, it's not like the 1961 Village Vanguard recording from November, where these guys knew they were being recorded and there was goal of like putting out an album. This is just a night. It's a field recording type of thing. It's not like, okay, we're the Who, we're at Leeds, we're going to cut a live album, we're doing the song again. It's not like that. So it has very much a You Are There component to it.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Now, speaking of books, did I read somewhere along the way? I know once you're done, you're on to the next, but you've got a new one, I believe, coming out next week?
I do, next Monday, Kimball. So all you people out there who have been tasked, and, well, asked politely, it's great to buy three books in 4 months. Here's the third one, and it's the last one for a while. It's called If You Brackets. That's the main title, and the subtitle is Fabula, Fantasy, Bleepery, word you can't say on the radio,
right.
Hope, because we all need hope, and it's I believe it's described as a punk rock triple album in story form. So every single story is in a different style. There's young adult, there's avant-garde, there's horror, there's a Beatles story. And yes, buy my book, please.
There you go. Get it. We'll talk about it soon. Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Thank you, my friend. We'll check in again next week.
All right. Sounds good.